We thought that tax credit would kickstart the housing market?
Maybe not.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. The number of people seeking mortgages has dipped from its six-month high. Applications for home loans also fell, and that's despite some of the lowest rates in years.
A British tax extends across the pond. You know how we feel about taxes in the monarchy. And quality control for the new Mao Zedong. But first, new home sales in this country fell back a full third, 33% last month. Analysts say people stopped looking to buy because a government tax credit dried up. The Commerce Department said today the new home sales pace for May was the slowest on record, dating all the way back to 1963. Patrick Emerson teaches economics at Oregon State University. He's with us to talk about the new home sales numbers. Hello.
Good morning.
It looks like the housing market's dried up. Wow. I mean, what happened?
Well, of course, there was the expiration of the new home buyer tax credit that moved a lot of sales early that were going to happen later, and now we're seeing the aftermath.
I mean, the aftermath, I mean, was it just the tax credit that was bringing all these people into home buying, or was it something else?
Well, the Federal Reserve has intervened in long-term credit markets, keeping mortgage rates down, so it's been a good time to buy, but a lot of people who might be interested in buying in 2010 probably bought early.
I'm wondering if this might be an indication of how buyers feel about new homes. I mean, is there something about a new home that they're sort of staying away from, or... I mean, are there better deals with existing or I dare say, used homes?
Yeah, well, often used homes are more desirable because they're in older, more established neighborhoods. And throughout the housing decline, a lot of the big drops in home values happened out in the suburbs where there were a lot of speculative building happened. And so I think that probably buyers are fairly cautious when they're looking at new homes about their ability to retain the value.
Retain the value in those new homes. Yeah, and we're talking about developments too, right, in cities across the country.
That's right.
Yeah. Summer is usually a big season for construction. I mean, what do we expect to see for the rest of the summer, sir?
Yeah, I'm worried that the summer is actually going to be quite subdued. I think that the building industry ramped up for a while. They were looking for a reason to be optimistic. Indications suggested that perhaps the recovery would be catching up more steam now. But I think what they've been given today is a real dose of cold water. And I think probably what they're going to do is start constraining the new home construction.
Economics Professor Patrick Emerson at Oregon State. Thank you, sir.
That's my pleasure.
For more on this, we turn to economist Richard DeKayser. He's president of Woodley Park Research, and he joins us every Wednesday from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Richard, the housing market gets a lot of attention because it's very familiar to us. It's very relatable. But is it so much of an economic driver that we should be sweating it?
Well, I think we should. Housing in the strict sense, building, selling, and refurbishing homes is only about 3% of GDP. But it's people's biggest asset, and hence when its price is going down, people feel less wealthy and spend more conservatively. And it's also the biggest asset on most banks' balance sheets. So when those loan losses are high, they're more reluctant. They're taking big losses and more reluctant to extend credit. That's the biggest factor in the credit crunch over the past year. So it is important beyond its narrowest definition.
Richard DeKayser, Woodley Park Research. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, some better news on the economic front today. The prospects for hiring are up, according to an association of chief executives. The Business Roundtable said its survey shows more than twice as many of its CEOs expect to hire workers as opposed to laying people off, the highest hiring percentage in 3 years. 4,000 nurse practitioners are descending on Phoenix today for their annual conference. The mood is good there. After decades of fighting for recognition, the national focus on primary care and on cutting costs could be just what the nurse practitioner ordered. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Gregory Warner has that.
Nurse practitioners are nurses with a master's degree. They can diagnose disease, prescribe medication, and interpret lab tests like a primary care doctor. But most states still require a medical doctor to sign off as collaborator.
We have nurse practitioners in rural areas that can't find a collaborator.
Jan Towers is director of health policy for the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. She's fighting state laws to make it easier for them to practice. On the federal level, healthcare reform law does recognize nurse practitioners and creates lots of new primary care positions for them to fill. Nurse practitioners charge less than doctors, and they can spend more time with patients. Patricia Stone is with Columbia University School of Nursing.
Talking to the patient, listening to their problems, that takes time. But when you can do that, you can encourage the person to make changes.
Changes, she says, that can keep people out of the hospital and off of medication. And that saves money. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Now, it's not a piece of mail that's welcomed everywhere, the jury summons. It's a civic obligation, yes, but in this recession, jury duty can also be a financial burden. And that's making it harder to find jurors. Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
Richard Gabriel is the president of a national trial consulting firm in Los Angeles. So he is asked the same question every single day.
How do I get out of jury service?
Sorry, he doesn't have an answer. But he says courts are having a tougher time with folks trying to get out of jury service. Blame the economic downturn. Jury service can affect those who are unemployed, especially. It can mean less time to look for work. Last year in Los Angeles County, more than 25% of the jury pool were excused because of financial hardship. Gabriel says the recession has stressed court systems all over the country.
Judges have actually gotten tougher on some jurors because they've heard so many excuses over the years.
But the real pressure is that states are hard-pressed themselves, so they can't raise jury payments. California only pays $15 a day. Gail Rudeman-Fuhr is the site judge for the Metropolitan Courthouse in Los Angeles. She wishes states paid more, but she says judges have a strict policy on who can be dismissed for economic reasons.
A true financial hardship would be someone who really won't be able to pay their bills. They're going to be thrown out of their apartment or their house.
Most major cities have to call more than 10,000 jurors a day in order to fill jury boxes. Still, Judge Fuhr says that the public should remember this.
If everyone who has some difficulty is excused, you're going to have a jury of either senior citizens or very rich people. That is not a cross-section of our society.
Here in California, there are no plans to raise the jury payment from $15 a day. But there is another solution that some local court systems are trying, sending out even more jury summons. In Los Angeles, I'm Nancy Fargali for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, June 23rd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. The British government today continues to grapple with an emergency budget that includes a big tax increase and spending cuts. But one measure included in the plan has proven very popular, a new tax on banks. Supporters are speaking out in London and all across Europe. Still, the idea hasn't been getting the warmest of receptions here in the U.S. Marketplace Europe correspondent Stephen Beard is with us from London to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
A bank tax in the U.K., is this sort of punishment for the financial crisis?
Partly, yes. The government here says the banks helped create the crisis, so they should help clean up the mess. But the tax won't be punitive. It's expected to raise about $3 billion a year. Not a huge amount, given the size of Britain's banking industry. Mm.
But, Stephen, this is the global economy, right? I mean, I'm sure there are some critics who say that the banks will just move somewhere else where there's not a tax.
That's the worry. But coinciding with yesterday's budget in Britain, France and Germany, also big banking centres, said they're going to have a similar tax, so no point in banks relocating there. And this does put pressure on the US to push through its own bank levy, which seems to have become bogged down in Washington. Bank analyst Michael Press says this move by Britain, France and Germany makes it easier for the US to follow suit.
If politicians on Capitol Hill wanted to press ahead with any kind of similar duty and levy in the States, I mean, they could make that point that it's quite possible to do this without it really having any great impact on the competitive position.
But Press says Wall Street may well argue that by not imposing a bank tax, the US could steal a march on European rivals and attract more international bank business to the US.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met with California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger last night. Today, the Russian leader will tour Silicon Valley. He's going to meet with tech honchos at Google and Twitter and Cisco Systems. Why is Medvedev in the Golden State? From Moscow, Peter Van Dyke reports.
50 years ago, as the Soviet Union struggled to feed itself, Premier Nikita Khrushchev visited Iowa to learn about farming. Now, as President Medvedev struggles to move Russia from an oil-based economy to a knowledge-based one, he's visiting California. Back home, he's promised tax breaks and incentives to develop a tech hotbed outside Moscow that's being dubbed Russia's Silicon Valley. Esther Dyson is an American journalist who's been investing in Russian tech startups for 20 years and is involved in the new project.
For Silicon Valley to be successful, it doesn't need just government support, it needs popular support. Because these people need to say, that's where I want my kids to work.
Dyson says it's not just a financial shift that's needed among Russian citizens, but a cultural one.
Now, if you tell your mother you're going to go into business, she says, oh dear, go into government, it's safer, it's stable, you'll get rich.
That is what Medvedev is trying to overcome. After his California adventure, he'll head to Washington, where he'll meet with President Obama on Thursday. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, June 23rd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. The Obama administration is quickly regrouping to try to reinstate its six-month moratorium on deepwater oil drilling. Yesterday, a Louisiana judge threw out the ban while he hears a court challenge brought by oil services companies. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar has been on Capitol Hill this morning explaining to senators why the temporary ban is the best way to ensure that future drilling is safe for workers and the environment. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The Louisiana judge said the administration's temporary ban on exploratory drilling wasn't justified and could harm the economy of the Gulf region. The administration has said it'll appeal to put the ban back in place. Barbara Shook of the Energy Intelligence Group, a research outfit in Houston, says the halt on drilling in U.S. waters is widely unpopular, especially among the hundreds of thousands of oil workers who are involved in drilling operations that haven't had safety problems.
I think it would be a big benefit if a blanket moratorium is withdrawn, but I think because of the egos involved that it will not be.
And as the oil leak and its damage drag out, BP has announced its CEO, Tony Hayward, will take a back seat in the company's response. Responsibility is being handed over to local BP boss Bob Dudley, who grew up in Mississippi. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
President Obama was scheduled to meet today with leaders from both parties to work on a compromise energy and climate plan. That meeting's been postponed. But as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, the move towards finding a bipartisan energy plan is still underway.
Senate Energy Committee Chairman Jeff Bingaman says there's plenty of agreement on encouraging alternative fuels, but to go further and force businesses to cut pollution, that'll take some arm twisting by the president.
I've always had trouble seeing how we got to the 60 votes that are needed to include some kind of limit and reduction in greenhouse gases as part of a bill.
If the government limits pollution, the price of carbon-based energy will go up, and senators are skittish about that prospect in an economy with nearly 10% unemployment. But Trevor Hauser's research for the Peterson Institute for International Economics says passing a climate change bill would actually help the economy.
Right now, you have billions of dollars of investment that's sitting on the sidelines waiting for a clear policy signal from Washington. Unleashing that investment would have a significant stimulative effect in the near term.
Hauser says maybe that's a message the president can use to switch some votes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. Shoppers love rewards programs. You can rack up miles or store credit just for spending money. Businesses also love rewards programs because they know most of your rewards will be wasted. When Los Angeles Times business columnist David Lazarus sees consumer waste, he springs to action. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Which company's in your sights now?
I've been looking at CVS Caremark. They're one of the biggest pharmacy chains in the country, and they've got a pretty impressive rewards program. You carry a little card with you in your wallet or your purse. Every time you go to the cash register to purchase, they scan it, thus getting a whole lot of really valuable information about you and your purchase. And in return, they say you're going to get 2% back on your purchases. Well, what they do to give you back your so-called extra bucks is they tack them onto your receipt. And this receipt is about a yard long. It's as long as your arm. In other words, they expect you to schlep the receipt around until you're going to use these as a sort of coupon.
Companies often make their rewards programs or their rebates hard to take advantage of. Why do they bother having those programs?
This is what's known in the retail industry as breakage, and many businesses do it. For example, no airline expects you to cash in all your frequent flyer miles. No retailer expects you to send in all your rebate forms. If you did, these guys would go broke. Now, in CVS's case, it's a little bit more insidious because they are giving you the 2% discount, but then they're making you jump through all these hoops to redeem the reward. And I talked to some marketing experts who say, this is a particularly consumer-unfriendly way of doing it.
And you also talked to CVS about it.
I did. I talked to their chief marketing officer, and I said, hey, if you want the 64 million people who are a part of this program to actually enjoy their rewards, why are you making it so tough? And he said, you know what? You're right. And he says what they're going to do in the future is stop putting it on the bottoms of those yard-long receipts and instead start putting the rewards into people's cards where they should be so that when you flash your card at the cash register, you'll get your discount immediately. That's a reward program.
But isn't that going to cost them a ton of money if the rewards program is actually rewarding?
You would think. They said they gave out about $2 billion in rewards last year, but only a small fraction of that amount was redeemed. So when I asked how can you possibly afford that, they say, oh, well, we'll make it up in volume. I'm not sure about that, but at least they're talking the talk.
LA Times business columnist David Lazarus, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, starting next week, Chinese statues of Chairman Mao sold near his birthplace will be of higher quality.
Local officials in Hunan province say some of the statues coming out of stores there are not up to snuff. The materials are cheap. The heads and bodies are disproportional.
So starting next week, all Mao Zedong statues sold will have to pass a new stringent quality control measure.
Yes, it's a new Mao. And he's lead free. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.